You're listening to KenCast. This episode was recorded in front of a live internet audience. And here's your host, Ken Cole.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to KenCast. Today, we're going to be talking about entertainment and the role of nostalgia in entertainment. That's right. Nostalgia, we love it. It's like sugar. It's like something delectable. But could too much be bad for us? And that's going to be something we're going to be talking about today. So without further ado, I want to bring in a very special guest. This is a first-time guest to KenCast. He is someone who has encyclopedic knowledge of movies and TV shows, especially entertainment from our past. And I thought he would be the perfect person to bring on this show today to talk with us about the impacts of nostalgia on pop culture. It's my pleasure to introduce Doug Leaf. Doug, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Great to be here, Ken.
Great to have you. And Doug, you have this amazing podcast, which I've been honored to appear on. It's Nostalgia Marcanum. Can you please tell us a bit about your podcast?
Sure. So as the name suggests, it's a nostalgia podcast. And the whole point is to interview a guest and talk about something that they love or are obsessed with from their childhood and sort of dig into why they still love it, what makes it worth reliving or revisiting. And so it's a really positive show. It's a lot of fun to just kind of find out about people's emotional connection to the subject matter, as well as just sort of relive just a really fun topic from the past. So you can see a few of our recent ones there. If you scroll down a bit, we'll get to the ones you were on, which people are your fans. You were on, gosh, we had you on for The Karate Kid early on. We did Superman the movie. We did Terminator 2 Judgment Day. And coming out in a few weeks for Halloween, we did Resident Evil 4. So stuff all over the map, something for everybody.
Yeah, it's always a blast. And I have to say, diving into these topics with you on this podcast, it's so insightful. I always learn something even being a guest. It's I think, Doug, you have such a unique perspective. It's such I would say a learned perspective on all of this, whether it's movies, TV shows, or games, right? We're going to be talking about Resident Evil 4 in an upcoming episode for you. And so you really have this broad view of pop culture. And what made you want to jump into this topic? Because the name of the show is Nostalgia Marcanum. What made you want to jump into this topic for a podcast?
So the short answer is just I'm a big old nerd and I like nerding out about pop culture. So it was like, well, I have to do this in front of a microphone or it doesn't count. But the real answer is I used to do a show called A Podcast, But Evil. And the remit of that show was to do a show about a different villain every episode. And so me and my co-host, we'd put the show aside and we were talking about getting it back together. And so I did a bunch of research for topics. And then the thing still didn't quite come together. And I was like, well, I did all this research and I really feel like getting back on the mic. So I just did those as solo episodes by myself for this show. And so like, all right, I'm going to keep that going. I'm going to start bringing on guests because just me monologuing is not going to be interesting to anybody. And so that kind of was the genesis of the show. And again, just sort of having this broad view of pop culture, not just saying just movies or just games. Like I wanted to be flexible in terms of what we covered. And it's turned out to be a great fun project because every week I get to wrap myself in a warm blanket of like, oh, wasn't this thing cool? And so I'm always revisiting something that I love from the past.
That's wonderful. And you can see everyone why I think of Doug as the nostalgia doctor. And we're going to be bringing him on today to talk about so many great things. As you can see right now, I've got my Ken shirt on. Which is from a movie, which you may or may not know. This movie played on people's nostalgia as well. So, there's so much to talk about today. Doug, I have to point out your amazing background. And I have to say that background gives me so much nostalgia right now. I have so many happy memories of playing Super Mario Brothers. And so can you give us an idea of what nostalgia is? What is that magic secret sauce? What is it about nostalgia that touches us as well?
Nostalgia is that feeling you get for things you loved from your childhood, right? It's that feeling of like, you're being transported in time back to when you were a kid. And, if you're you know, obviously not everybody had a fortunate childhood, but most people, I think of their childhoods as happy because you're free of responsibility. And so it's your time to figure out who you are, fall in love with things, and to be heavily influenced by the media you consume. So when we look at this stuff that we're nostalgic for, you and me, we're in the same cohort. So we're looking at stuff from like the 80s mostly and 90s. That's the stuff that means so much to us. And so it's not surprising that, you know, you see this in media because the people who make movies and TV, they're standing on the shoulders of whatever they were inspired by. And you can see there's like that 30-year cycle, right? So a lot of the media we grew up with in the 80s, there's a whole lot of 50s nostalgia going on. It's not surprising why. All the kids that grew up in the 50s started making movies in the 80s. And so now we're getting a lot more of 80s and 90s stuff in our entertainment. So I think what nostalgia does for us is it's like a drug that is kind of a straight shot to like your the most passionate parts of you. Right. It's that thing. This is like, especially for a filmmaker, I want to make that. I want to make one of those. And if you're a viewer, then it's like, it takes me back. You know, it's a drug, but it can be a good drug.
Okay. That's interesting how you put that. It can be a good drug. So let's start there. When it is a good drug, what are some examples for you where it is a good drug, or a way that nostalgia is used effectively in new projects, new entertainment?
I think some good examples of this. So things from my childhood that I thought were original and amazing, right? Until I knew better. The first things that come to mind are Star Wars and Indiana Jones, right? And everybody at a certain point realizes, what George Lucas and Steven Spielberg were doing were making these serials that they grew up with. And then they made their own thing inspired by that. A more modern example of this would be something like Stranger Things, right? I think Stranger Things is a synthesis of all this 80s stuff. And they proudly wear their influences on their sleeves, but it's not a regurgitation. It's not just, you know, it's not a, let's just literally make another thing, you know, like, hey, we're just going to make Goonies 2. Right. It's not the same characters in the same world. It's their own thing that you can see that they were it's inspirational as opposed to just regurgitational. I think that's always the key difference is, are you producing something that you're inspired by, or are you attempting to replicate the thing? And if it's the latter, that's when you can always tell as an audience it rings hollow.
Okay, that's really interesting. And I think we're going to dive into that today about, like, you know, what is this difference? When does it ring hollow? Why does it ring hollow? I love that you brought up Stranger Things, because that was a show that, like, occasionally you have like the specific references to things that are happening in the 80s, but really the approach, the feel, there are so many intangibles in that that just feel very comfy to someone who, say, grew up in the 80s. You know, it's like it seems like they really did a great job of interpreting their own experience, you know, through the filmmaker's perspective of, you know, bringing the 80s to now. And so you're saying that there's that element of sort of creative interpretation where it's new and you're kind of bringing that feel of an era or feel of a shared memory, but it's a new interpretation of it. There's creativity. It stands alone in and of itself.
Well, sure. If you look at the characters in Stranger Things, they aren't one-to-one copies of characters you've seen before. They have their own wants and needs. They're three-dimensional fleshed out characters with their own universe and their own interesting story happening. So the 80s setting and, you know, the music, the motifs, it's additive as opposed to subtractive. You could tell that Stranger Things story and set it in 2023, right? It wouldn't ultimately affect the story that much, other than that maybe people would have cell phones and you'd be having a lot of bullshit scenes where people go, oh no, I have no bars to take them out of the air. If anything, that will probably force more stories that take place before the age of cell phones, if nothing else, because they're too awful as a plot problem. But as far as the Stranger Things, the show goes, there will be times when they reference stuff literally, like there's a scene where the kids are playing Dragon's Lair in an arcade, right? But you look at the film grain, the way it's shot, the way the music is done. There's a lot in there that is more about the feel of the 80s and the pop culture of the 80s than it is about trying to duplicate a specific moment, a franchise, even anything. It's just, it's truly its own thing that is like, I think it's one of the best uses of nostalgia in recent memory.
Yeah, I agree. They really did an effective job with that series. I can't wait to see the last season. 80s nostalgia. Great name for today's discussion.
Everything was better.
Everything was better before, but it's the quality. My 8-year-old niece says the 80s was better. So this is kind of an interesting phenomenon. It looks like a younger generation now is also a bit enamored with the 80s. And I don't know if you have personal experience with that. Is there something about the 80s that also appeals to just this young generation that was never alive anywhere near the 80s?
It's tubular in a way that things before it were not. I think what's special about the films of the 80s, and I think to the 90s to a large extent too, there was a change that happened between the 70s and 80s in terms of filmmaking. You look at films before 1980, and there tends to be a lot fewer that have kind of matriculated down for people to share. Because even as growing up as a kid in the 80s, right? My parents were born in the second half of the 1940s. And you would think that then they would have instilled a lot of pop culture of saying like, hey kid, you got to watch this movie from 1962. Right. And they didn't, there wasn't as many movies from that era that they were like, hey, you got to watch this. Music. Yes. It was a lot of, in my house, it was like, yeah, we got to listen to the Beatles. We got to listen to the Rolling Stones, all this great musical output of the '60s and seventies. But I think just in terms of the ability to make films, to put your imagination on screen, and the way things were written changed. Things for kids in the 70s and 60s were very much for kids. And so a lot of those movies, with the exception of maybe some Disney classics and stuff, don't hold up. It's a lot of Herbie the Love Bug stuff that mm-hmm. It's especially those earlier versions. If you grew up with them, you might have some feelings for them, but I couldn't imagine showing a lot of those movies to my kids and having them react to it. But I'm excited to show stuff from the 80s to my kids because I think it's just written and produced in a different way that has that's made that stuff stand the test of time. You've also got an environment now where the people in charge of entertainment are with Stranger Things, it's a lot of references to that stuff. Right. So if you watch Family Guy, 70% of the jokes by volume are 80s references. Right. So if you've never seen any of that stuff, the media you're watching is making jokes about stuff from the 80s. It's bringing it forward in a way that the most we get, I didn't grow up with stuff giving me a whole lot of references from the 40s and 50s and 60s, right? Of maybe, some cartoons will show you that stuff, but it's not there. So in terms of were the 80s better? I don't know that they were better, but they were different in a way that's made them carry forward towards now. And again, you're getting a lot of concerted effort to mine that nostalgia and bring it forward in various ways. So there's definitely, so I can't say it was better, but it's more present and more distilled, if that makes sense.
Right. And as you were saying that, it made me think of also something that came about during the 80s as far as TV and movies was a prevalence of home media. The idea that a lot of these movies and TV shows were all of a sudden maybe a lot more accessible. You didn't have to rely on it being broadcast on television or be re-released in theaters, which I think was a lot of people experienced those movies. Say The Wizard of Oz, of course, that was broadcast every year, so everyone knew what The Wizard of Oz was. Disney classics, you mentioned, were re-released over the years in theaters, and that's how people would experience that. But they didn't have a copy to rent or purchase really until the 80s, and VHS became a big thing. Do you think the prevalence of home media, physical media, since that time, and I guess now we have digital streaming and YouTube, do you think that's increased the awareness, I guess you could say, or consumption of 80s content in a way that prior generations didn't have that opportunity to reach new audiences?
Yes and no. because the home medium, the home video market, right? Everybody I grew up with, they got their hands on a VCR and were able to watch everything, but all the old stuff was still released on VHS. So if you wanted to go watch a movie from, you know, earlier than the 80s, you could get your hands on it and watch it. But it did mean there was a more bit of a immediacy to seeing a movie in the theaters and being able to get your hands on it. And once you got your hands on it, you could watch it over and over and over again in a way that would become like kind of pop culture, like fabric of your life, in a way that you'd be like, oh yeah, I remember I saw the Godfather. That was pretty good. You know, and you may not have seen it 50 times. Right.
Right.
There's something about seeing something over and over and over again that now it's like, yeah, that's a part of me. It's in my DNA now.
Right. And in previous weeks, we had Rich Baker, who's been a frequent guest on your podcast, Nostalgia Marcanum.
Yeah, that's how we met.
Amazing pairing. You guys are a dynamic duo. I love listening to you guys. And he was on here talking about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. And he talked about that movie, knowing that movie every line by heart. He could recite the entire movie from memory. And what you're talking about, I think, was only possible, right, after you could watch it over and over again. Because, you know, before the 80s, you probably couldn't, you know, have these lines just at your disposal and be able to recite a movie by memory.
It would have to be a real memorable line, right? You know, for something earlier than that, you know, to come through. And yeah, Rich was on our show talking about TMNT as well. And you're right. He can recite that movie by heart. And I bet there's a lot of movies you can recite by heart. Me too, for that reason. And you think of like, what's a memorable quote? Well, you know, you think of like, you know, Gone with the Wind or whatever, you know, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That's one line out of a 4-hour movie. That, you know, now if that movie was released today, I bet there's a lot more lines that would be ending up on t-shirts and stuff, you know, because it was like, oh yeah, I remember that other line. It's not just the like A plus head of the class. Like that's a memorable zinger. It's like the B tier stuff. That's now like, yeah, that's still also memorable and good.
Right.
You know, stop trying to make fetch happen. That stuff.
Right. And that the B tier, C tier stuff, if you know that, I think you get some kind of pop culture cred sometimes, right? It's sort of like totally. If you're able to recite that and if you're able to recognize that, that means you have kind of some credibility, some deeper level understanding of movie or TV show.
Oh, 100%. I definitely agree. Like you see people with something on a t-shirt that is one of those lines and there's that moment where you pass each other and you go like, I know. And yeah, you like the Big Lebowski too, don't you? You know, right? It's the same. Yeah, we both love it. So yeah, I think that plays a big role. Absolutely. Again, that being able to not just watch a movie, but like internalize it, that changes things.
100%. Absolutely. We have some amazing comments from you guys. Mm-hmm. Clifford says, excellent point. Talking about Stranger Things. Stranger Things reminds me of Amazing Stories. Yes, indeed. Matt Moore, thanks for being a channel member, Matt. The 80s and 90s were the best time to grow up. I want to give my kids just a little piece of what they missed. And that's an interesting thought too, isn't it, Doug? Because I remember when I grew up, it almost looked like the 50s were presented as this very ideal time to grow up. Everything was just so, the representation of the 50s, it just seemed like a magical time. If we could only go back to the 50s, everything was so nice and safe, you know, maybe from certain people's perspective, but now you have this idea that the 80s and 90s were really the perfect time to grow up.
That is what nostalgia does. It takes your childhood and turns it into, well, of course things were perfect because my life was carefree and easy. I do have obviously a big soft spot for the pop culture of the 80s and 90s because that was my childhood. Where if you were 40 in the 80s, you know, economically it wasn't the best time, right? We were, you know, inches from us and Russia blowing each other up. There's a lot of reasons the 80s and 90s were well, maybe the 90s was pretty chill, but the 80s was pretty rough for a lot of people. So that is just something that pop culture does. And certainly the 50s were pretty bad for a lot of people. So, you know, but yeah, if you're Stephen King growing up in the 50s, you grow up to write Stand By Me and It, and you see this version of the 50s back then where it's all like, yeah, man, we're all riding around on bikes and having milkshakes and listening to doo-wop and everything was fine. Because when you were 9 years old in the 50s, that's what it was. Right. So I do think for sometimes nostalgia is like this Vaseline on the lens of history that makes us go like, yeah, everything was awesome. As opposed to like, it, you know, maybe it wasn't. And there's a lot of pop culture things from those earlier eras that are awesome. Right. But they maybe don't bleed through to us as much, again, because of the kind of the filmmaking stuff, the technological stuff that's made the stuff from the 80s and 90s stick around maybe longer than it otherwise would have.
Yes, yes, indeed. Now, we have an interesting comment from 80s Nostalgia. He says, I live in Taiwan, and in their culture, nostalgia is frowned upon. It's looked at as an attachment. I've spoken to many people about it here, and they don't understand why we Americans are so nostalgic. So I think this is kind of an interesting point to bring up, because it seems like Taiwanese culture is keying into the fact that maybe nostalgia isn't always a great thing. Maybe it is an attachment, is something that might be baggage, something that we can't let go. We're not looking at the present and into the future. I don't know. How would you maybe start to transition into this idea that nostalgia is not always good?
I get the perspective, the idea of like you're stuck in the past and then you're not forward looking. On the other hand, everyone has a past. You all come with all of the stuff you've seen, and it informs who you are now and what you will do in the future. So there's no way to avoid that, right? We're all creatures of what we grow up with. If you're only looking to the past, I can understand that is, you know, that is limiting, but I guess that could be that, you know, nostalgia is a bad drug kind of stuff that we touched on earlier. But I don't know that I would agree with quite that cultural perspective. And again, obviously I am not Taiwanese. I cannot speak to that worldview. But to me, it's a caring and loving thing. As this person who says, like, I can't wait to introduce the 80s, 90s nostalgia to my kids. It's you just literally saying, I liked this thing. It makes me happy. I want you to be happy. Here, try this thing. Right. It's not any more complicated than that. And so I'm not sure how I would relate to someone who felt like it was, you should just jettison the past as this, you know, meaningless thing. There's room for both. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
Right. And I know everyone watching right now, you're watching from sometimes across the world. So if you feel like your country or your culture or even your family has certain attitudes towards nostalgia that might be different from, say, your average American's ideas, let us know in the comments. We'd love to hear your perspective. Matt Moore says Americana came back in a big way in the 80s and continued through the 90s. And Marianella, great to see Marianella, says before everything was simpler and we settled for little, a few channels that showed content for the whole family, the family sitting in front of the television watching a series or movie, you know, and that is kind of an attractive idea as well. This idea that the entire family gets together around one screen, has a shared experience, and that's changed quite a bit. And I could see why there might be nostalgia for those times, because it seems like everyone has their own screen. We're having a sort of separated media consumption experiences. Whereas back in the 80s, I mean, you had a TV, maybe a couple TVs, but you were watching stuff together as a family, fewer channels.
There is something to be said for that we used to have more of a monoculture, right? Where there were certain pipelines where you would get your, entertainment from. You would get, you know, here's what's playing at the movies. Here's what's on these 13 channels we all get and we have to watch live at the same time. And here's what's on the radio stations around the country. And by and large, someone was drip feeding us, you know, here are the things you get to choose from, right? Now that's been way more democratized. So not only do you have pretty much the entire library of human copyrightable content at your fingertips anytime you like it, there are countless podcasts and YouTube channels, guys like us, and sources and channels, streamers. There's so many places to get content from that it's harder for us to all be on the same page culturally in terms of what's, you know, is coming along. So it takes a bigger kind of pop culture event with a gravitational force big enough. So you're wearing your Ken shirt from the Barbie movie, right? That was gigantic. But if it's not on that level, right, if it's not that huge of an entertainment thing, we're not all going to be noticing it and talking about it at the water cooler and making jokes about it. So it's harder for that stuff to break through. So I don't know what whether that has an effect on this nostalgic period we're in now, looking back at the 80s and 90s, I don't know. What's going to be really interesting is how it affects the entertainment that's being produced 30, 40 years from now.
Right. I know. And you were mentioning the Barbie movie and those big cultural moments. We also had another, probably the runner up to Barbie this year was, as we can see from Doug's background. Oppenheimer. I was also going to mention the Super Mario Brothers movie. Sure. So we had a movie that I had such a great experience with, but I think is completely based on nostalgia. I would think that one of the main reasons that was so successful is because we've had multiple generations now that have so many hours played of that game. They loved Super Mario, the character of Mario, and that just propelled the movie going forward. But, you know, you bring up an interesting point about Oppenheimer. Okay. And how would you say that movie relates to nostalgia?
I hope nobody has a whole lot of nostalgia for World War II and the atomic bomb. I think what it was nostalgic for in terms of people going to see it had nothing to do with the subject matter. What it had to do with was it's been a while since we've had a major drama that people want to go see, and you need a director of the stature that Christopher Nolan has earned to be able to get people to show up in droves to go see Oppenheimer, because people don't want to go to the movies anymore generally, and they usually don't want to go see dramas. I think of a film that we all love, like The Shawshank Redemption, and like, there isn't a market for that movie today. It wouldn't exist because no one would want to make that. All of the stuff that wins Academy Awards, usually, it's all the stuff that, like, I think if you remember on 30 Rock, they made that movie called Hard to Watch, which was the Oscar bait, which is literally like, okay, let's see. Can we put her through the Holocaust and a capsized ocean liner? What can we do to, you know, make this as miserable a human being as possible, so we can enjoy this movie for award season? That mid-tier drama range that existed in the 80s and 90s is gone, and the pandemic didn't do that any favors, right? So getting people to go to the movies at all is hard. So it's got to be something that people really want to go see. And I think there was a little bit of that, like, oh man, we get to go see this adult, interesting film that is actually worth seeing on a big screen, as opposed to, you know, watching a very high caliber actor just cry in front of an armoire in the 1800s, right? That does not require the big screen. So there is a nostalgic thing to Oppenheimer, but yeah, like I said, not the movie itself, but that feeling of like, I want to go to the movies and see something like that.
I think that's a brilliant point. And when I saw Oppenheimer, I was taken back to, say, the 90s, when I used to enjoy going to the movies. And we were used to seeing all these like really original dramas, like you said, the sort of the mid-tier budget dramas that were lauded. I mean, people who went to the movies enjoyed going to see that. And it was interesting that Oppenheimer did so well. And I bring that up because the studios had launched a number of big movies this year. We could say things like the remake of Disney's Little Mermaid. We could say Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. A lot of huge budgeted movies that were made specifically to cater to your nostalgia. And they didn't do well or failed in a big way. Yet a movie that is maybe reminiscent of the 90s or the types of film experiences we used to have did very well. And so my question is, are we at a tipping point where, I know you talked about nostalgia sometimes being hollow, where maybe we're sick of these sort of, could we call it nostalgia bait, nostalgia plays for our wallets? What's going on here where it seems like audiences are rejecting these blatant nostalgia vehicles, but we're enjoying things like Oppenheimer?
So you have to look at the business perspective, which is, if I'm a studio and I want to make something and I know that people are less likely to show up to the theater now than they used to be, using nostalgia is a way to hopefully up the profits of the movie by going, well, people will be, it's a property they already know, right? I want to go see the Little Mermaid live action because I loved the 1989 original and I want to see what they do with it, right? They're not giving you anything original at all. I actually watched a little of that last night randomly. Just happened to, we're getting together with some of the our kids and their friends, and someone put it on, and I hated it, to be blunt. Like, it was just like, this doesn't need to exist. There's no point to it. It made $800 million, right? So when you say we're at a tipping point, like when the Little Mermaid live action remake makes $800 million, the Lion King one, which I thought also sucked, made over $1 billion, right? If I'm a studio, it's hard to go, you want me to not make $1 billion? You know, right. That argument is lost on everybody. And even Dial of Destiny, which I kind of liked, I wasn't over the moon about it, but it was a sight better than Crystal Skull. When you say like, oh, it was a failure, that was all the headlines. Oh, it was a failure. It still made hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and more than it's cost to make, right? Nobody lost money on it.
So it actually lost a ton of money.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
I'm surprised. I thought it made more than they spent on it.
The reporting on that movie has been, you know, interesting. I think they've spun it, but the movie itself cost at least $300 million to make.
Jesus.
And then they spent at least $150 million on marketing.
And that's where they lost it. I'll bet.
And well, right. And it made, I think it got up to around $380 million in the box office, but the studios only recoup half of that.
Well, that's so, the thing is you look at it and go like, we made something that made $380 million and it failed, right? There's a mismatch there. But setting that aside, I do think you're right. Audiences are hungry for something original, right? People are starting to feel a little tired of Marvel stuff and the MCU. At least that's kind of the zeitgeist. And you're still going to have to fight against this moneyed interest that's like, yeah, we know, but people don't want to go see movies and people don't want to take chances on original IP. Like, the original IPs aren't exactly blowing people away. Like, Oppenheimer is one movie. And even that is still at least based on a historical event people have heard of. It's not totally original, right? What that is, you know, hey, Christopher Nolan's back. That's what, and it happens to be next to Barbie, and this weird cultural moment happened where we all had to have fun of the idea of those two things being in adjacent theaters. But when I grew up, that was normal. Like, you know, it was playing alongside, like, you know, Tim Burton's Batman in the theaters. It was something totally different, right? It wasn't a big deal for stuff to be released at the same time. Here, the fact that there's any movie worth going to see is kind of interesting, let alone two at the same time. That's the news story, unfortunately. Right.
Right.
And so that is another place where, but the thing with Little Mermaid and Dial of Destiny, right? There's, like I said before, they're regurgitative. They're not innovative. They're not taking, someone didn't decide, hey, I'm going to make a new movie about a treasure hunting hero. They just said, let's wheel out Harrison Ford to do it one more time.
Which is fascinating because if we look back, say, at Raiders of the Lost Ark, that movie did play into nostalgia, but it was a completely new interpretation of that. It was taking, you know, people taking what they love from adventure and serials and you know, George Lucas and James Bond and presenting it in a new way through a new character, remixing it. And it was its own thing that harkened back to those times, but it was also legitimately current of that time. And it's interesting that now we have, say, like Indy 5, which is, you know, I think you put it well, is regurgitating essentially what has come before instead of like coming up with something new, something interpretive. I think that's fascinating.
I mean, I think that is the place where nostalgia does hold us back a bit. But the other thing is, like I said, we've got the other side of the coin with something like Stranger Things, where it's telling you like, this can work if you do the original thing with it. And I think studios, unfortunately, they seem to take the wrong lessons every time something is successful. You know, it'd be like, you know, if Titanic wins, you know, a bunch of Oscars, and then the studio's lesson from that is, oh man, people like movies about boats. Let's make more boat movies. And it's like, well, it wasn't the boat that people responded to, you know? And so I think that happens here a lot of times where it's like, okay, people love this thing. Let's just give them that thing. They take it wasn't the love and care that went into the story, you know, or anything else. It was just the thing they saw on screen. I want it on screen again.
Right. Fascinating. This is just very fascinating topic. I have a million more questions about this. I want to get to some comments. Matt Moore says, I refuse to see Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny because I can't reward that type of trash with this nostalgia bait. It's interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, it's okay. It's not a bad movie. And actually, if you want to, like, it will wipe the taste of Crystal Skull out of your mouth. So it might be worth doing it for just for that reason. So it's one of those things where you go, like, you still look at it and go, there is some love and care put into that. It's better than you think. But again, I still think the only reason that got made is that they just didn't want Indy to go out on the note, the down note that Crystal Skull was. So they had to redeem him, I think, a bit before they closed the book on that franchise. But that's a unique example, right? I think there's so many other things where we get legacy sequels, right?
Right.
Here's a sequel to a movie that was made 25 years ago, right? They're like, for me, Beetlejuice is like a top five movie. I love that movie to death. It was the first episode of the podcast that I did. And I'm, you know, I just can't believe they talked about doing it for, even back then, they've been kicking around ideas for a sequel to that movie. And now they're finally doing it. And I'm super skeptical that will be any good.
Like, I know it's, I just can't. This is a whole other topic of legacy sequels, because we have a few that have worked and a lot of them don't. But these are basically nostalgia plays. It's sort of like we've enough time has gone by where people are still interested in the movie. So we're going to try to make a sequel, a really late sequel, like a legacy sequel. Beetlejuice is one of them. I will say, and I know viewers of this channel will probably agree, one of the, you could call it a legacy sequel, that is absolutely phenomenal is Cobra Kai, being a legacy sequel to the Karate Kid series. It does its own thing, but taps into nostalgia, I think, for all the right reasons. And another one that seemed to have worked was Top Gun Maverick. That, in fact, you could make a case, I think it's, as a movie, maybe, you know, better than the original. That really worked very well. But
I agree.
So, but it seems like the batting average isn't very high on legacy sequels. So let's take a minute. Let's go through some. So you mentioned Beetlejuice 2. You're kind of nervous about that. What would you say, and this is a hot button topic, would be sort of Star Wars? So Disney now owns Star Wars. They made the sequel trilogy, very much a legacy sequel to the original trilogy. And they've made all kinds of different series, you know, like the Obi-Wan series was a prequel, you know, series. Yeah, interquel. What do you think of the new edition of Star Wars, the new versions of it, the new series, and its relationship to nostalgia and whether it's successful?
Star Wars is kind of a unique case because of how massive it is, right? I struggle to think of another franchise of that size. So what, I mean, and of course I grew up on the original trilogy. That's what I had. And the sequel, the Phantom Menace, is I think 99. So I was already 19 when that came out. And so, but one thing Star Wars did was it created a sandbox, right? Literal toys in a sandbox, basically going pew, pew, pew at each other. And my Star Wars experience growing up, aside from watching the movies, was taking my action figures and going pew, 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 pew. And now we've let other filmmakers pick up the action figures and go pew, 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 pew themselves, right? And so it's such a sprawling series now between, you know, all of this stuff that's considered canon between books and video games, stretching thousands of years before the events of the primary movies, and now stretching into the future beyond the primary movies into the sequel trilogy, that it's almost, I mean, yes, the existence of Star Wars is a nostalgia thing. But then again, you think of something like Superman, Batman, they've been around since the 30s and 40s, right? It's become so culturally ingrained in us that there's sort of room for everybody to play with it. So when a series like Andor comes along and people go, geez, this is really good, right? It, you know, it's taking an interesting angle on a galaxy far, far away. And then there's other things that take a totally different tone. The Clone Wars cartoons and Andor exist in the same continuity and are so far apart from each other tonally. And they're allowed, they have to, by Disney law, coexist. So I don't know that doing more Star Wars at this point is, it's almost hard to talk about it as nostalgia because it's sort of gone beyond that point of like, we're reaching back to those three original movies anymore. This is just an entire fantasy world that exists to tap into. So it's almost hard to line it up against anything else.
That's a really interesting point. It's now its own monster, for good or ill, I guess. It's its own thing. Disney is pumping out way more content than it used to.
The sandbox is so big that, you know, whether it's going to be good or bad ultimately does not depend on the nostalgia for Star Wars anymore, but it now depends on how good the storytelling is for the individual project. So I think that is kind of a good thing. It would be nice to see some other, you know, sci-fi stuff that's not, here's another Star Wars or Star Trek, series, right?
Right.
It's a big galaxy. There's a lot of stuff you could do in it.
Right. I know there's Star Trek too. And I don't know how many people on here are big Star Trek fans. Have you kept up with the new versions of Star Trek?
No, for me, I mean, I like Star Trek, but for me, my heart is always with the Next Generation. And I've seen a handful of the original series, the movies, some of the movies for the new generation, and then some of the first two J.J. Abrams ones. I wouldn't consider myself a Star Trek expert by any stretch. But, you know, even then, I do feel like the new Star Trek stuff has not been, I won't say it's necessarily bad, but it doesn't feel like Star Trek to me. Star Trek is about this very hopeful, mm-hmm. It's basically a very hopeful Twilight Zone set in space. And I don't feel like they've been doing that.
Yes. I'm a big and old time Star Trek fan. I obviously have a lot of nostalgia for Star Trek, and I would agree with you overall that the new versions of Star Trek have overall been very different, I think, at their core than what we used to get with the original series and also the Next Generation era. I will say Picard season 3, I think, is a very, very effective use of nostalgia. It's a very effective legacy sequel. If you enjoyed the Next Generation era, highly recommend season 3 only of Picard.
It's basically season 8 of Star Trek: The Next Generation. They brought back everybody, you know, to do that. So
yes,
yeah, and I haven't seen it, so I'll have to defer to you.
It's really amazing that they held off till season 3 to doing that. Terry Metalis, I think, does a great job, like John Hurwitz, Josh Heald, and Hayden Schlossberg on Cobra Kai. I think Terry Metalis does that same wizardry with Picard season 3. He was able to run that season, and it's great. I think people who like Next Generation will love it. Matt Moore, though, brings up another series that might use nostalgia. After seeing Terminator Dark Fate in theaters, I don't watch those kinds of movies without reading a bunch of reviews. So the Terminator series, Doug, we did Terminator 2, obviously regarded as a classic. Those first two Terminator movies, well-beloved by many people, including me. And it seems like the studios keep wanting to go back to Terminator and somehow kickstarting it, making it work. Again, they go back and back and back. And even as recently as Terminator Dark Fate, still having Arnold Schwarzenegger come back. So I don't know. What are your thoughts about the Terminator series now? And even if you haven't seen all those movies, just the idea of using that maybe perhaps nostalgia for that time in those first two movies to try to keep making more money.
A great example of, you're doing more of the drug, trying to get the same high you used to get.
Right.
Massive dip in quality after Terminator 2. And I think part of that is, as we talked about on that episode, Terminator 2 is kind of a singular story and vision. And it ends so well with that wonderful ambiguous ending that you can't replicate that. You know, the story of the world of Terminator is basically Terminator 1 and 2, as far as I'm concerned. And trying to keep what you're trying to do is you're really, again, trying to replicate, like, oh man, the success of that movie was, it was cool because of the time travel, or like the robots trying to kill you. And it was like, no, Terminator 2 is its own special alchemy in terms of like the all of the different elements coming together in that movie. And because of its the particulars of that movie's plot, I don't think you can replicate it. The entire point of that movie is this question of, you know, who are we as a species and can we change our future? Delving more into the future, it's like you can't go any farther than that. You sort of answered your question by the end of that movie. And after that, it's just more bang, bang, shoot 'em up stuff, which is soulless, I think.
Interesting. Hold on to that term soulless as we keep going. No pun intended. Johnny Utah brings up horror reboots have been doing well recently. Halloween, Scream, Chucky, Evil Dead. Saw 10 comes out next week and looks promising. And so I'm actually wondering if the horror genre might utilize nostalgia more than any other genre, or at least as much as any other genre. What are your thoughts on nostalgia in horror?
That's a great question. Horror is a little bit of a different beast in terms of a genre, because horror movies are a little like pizza. Like, even when they're bad, they're still good. you can make a really crappy horror movie that is a rollicking good time. And so, you know, it's not as something like, yeah, you made another Terminator movie and it's like, it's never going to be the same as watching, you know, the T-800 and John Connor Bond. You know, it's just not going to be the same. So with horror, yeah, you can get away with this stuff. Horror reboots can sometimes work. I don't particularly care for, like, say, the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot they did.
Right.
And again, The Fly is, I think, a magical movie that's a million times better than the original. So it can be done. And then you're talking about Saw 10 coming out. At a certain point, horror movies pass from being nostalgia. They go beyond that into becoming a tradition, which is, you know, you just repeat it over and over again because that's what we do, especially with Halloween, right, where, you know, all of the same characters have been coming out to haunt us. You know, like, oh, here's another Dracula. We're not tired of Dracula yet. You know, after that, you know, that book came out in the late 1800s, and he's still coming around in movies. So horror gives you this opportunity to, like, keep delving into stuff because the macabre is fun and there's kind of no wrong way to do it. So I want to say it's immune from the stuff we've been talking about, but it's like it's operating under a different set of laws of physics.
I love that. I think you're right about that. Jaws, thanks for joining us, Jaws. Hey, Ken. Hey, Doug. I would wish sequels of many 80s movies of John Hughes, Rob Reiner, or Robert Zemeckis, but probably they would not be profitable business for the movie companies. That's a very interesting comment, Jaws. People have been requesting or wanting or clamoring for, say, a sequel to Back to the Future. Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale have basically said, no, not while we're alive. We're never doing, you know, a sequel to Back to the Future. Do you think that's a good idea? Should we leave Back to the Future where it is? Or is that something that we should bring back if people want to see more adventures from the Back to the Future universe?
I mean, isn't that the lesson of the movie, right? Stop fucking with it. You're going to mess up the timeline. I would say no. Like, that is one of those examples where, like, it's better to let the past lie. I'm not going to say no one is clever enough to do an interesting reboot of Back to the Future. On the other hand, that is, like, that particular script is, like, taught in schools. It's like, this is a perfect script. Like, you're not going to better it. And that's one of those things where also, like, you're kind of playing with fire. Like, you know, is this going to be better than the original? Generally, with something that good, there's nowhere to go but down. So that is a problem. You also, again, the nature of that story, the way it ends is, you know, you literally have, like, Doc Brown on a train telling you, you know, the future is yours. It's whatever you make of it. So make it a good one. And he flies away on a train. Like, that's an ending. Just like with Last Crusade, right? Indiana Jones literally rides into the sunset. Leave it the hell alone sometimes, you know, that's okay. And you talk about sequels to, like, John Hughes and Rob Reiner movies. Legacy comedies, I think, we haven't even talked about comedy as a thing. That's much harder. It's rarely done. It's very hard to do well. Like, I realize, like, there's, like, my Big Fat Greek Wedding 3 coming out. Much harder to do because I think, you know, they're harder to franchise. Generally, a comedy is built around a character having a character flaw that they work through in with hilarious results. And by the end of the movie, you've resolved it. So comedy sequels in particular are really hard to do already, let alone a legacy sequel. And I don't need to see Meg Ryan faking it at her age in a deli, but that's just me being silly. But like, I can't think of a Rob Reiner movie that would work for a sequel. Do you want to see The Princess Bride 2? You certainly don't want to see A Few Good Men 2. And John, same with John Hughes. Like, John Hughes is about a tone. I think what you're talking about is, I want that feeling again. I want to watch a movie that makes me feel the way that these, you know, that The Breakfast Club made me feel. And the answer to that is, you know, those things do come along sometimes, but it won't be a sequel. Like, the quote unquote sequel to The Breakfast Club is My So-Called Life, right? Mm. Different show, different characters, similar high school environment and similar, you know, pangs and angst. So I think to go back to Stranger Things, that's the right answer. You don't need to see more of Lloyd Dobler. You need to see, you know, a new character struggling to work his way through a similar time in his life. And I think if it's done right, it will give you that feeling. And I don't want to be the guy that says never, because again, I would never suggest someone is not clever enough to do it. They made a goddamn Lego movie that will make you cry, right? Like, it worked. You know, so it's not impossible, but you're talking about just playing the averages. I think you want something that is soulful and not just, again, you know, we're just giving you literally the same stuff again.
I will admit that there is a large chunk of time where I was hoping that they would do a sequel to Spinal Tap. Like, where
they
put out
some albums.
Right. They put out some albums and
they appeared on The Simpsons.
Yep, indeed. Just sort of like a modern, like, where has this band been? Like, another mockumentary, maybe, like, with them, like, aging and like what's been going on. But yeah, it's, I think you're right. It can be perilous to come back to these properties, especially if you don't hit it right. Now, I will say, I think Cobra Kai has done it right. And Governor, thanks for your comment, Governor. Cobra Kai has done what Johnny says in season one, flip the script. A great blend of nostalgia and refreshing up the traditional good versus evil approach. And it was, I think they really did an amazing job. And I will say, I think the big three, John, Josh, and Hayden, they were interested in rebooting Back to the Future, but they weren't allowed to do it. But they found a very interesting way to get back into the Karate Kid universe and come at it from a whole new, fresh perspective. And it was kind of playing on the idea of 80s, you know, heroes versus villains, where you had Daniel LaRusso being the hero and Johnny was the villain. And it was like an amazing way in to that universe to look at it from Johnny's perspective. Where has he been? Was he really the bad guy, you know, or was Daniel the bad guy? And kind of having fun with that, but also exploring it. I don't know. It's just from a very textured perspective, changing roles where Johnny is kind of the new Miyagi in a way, which is, it's just so interesting. And I'm going to say this, Doug, and I want to get your thoughts. I think if you're going to use nostalgia in a legacy sequel or a new project, it's vitally important for that project to work despite the nostalgia. So you need it to work as a movie, and you can use nostalgia in it, but it can't depend on it. And it seems like a lot of projects get into trouble because the entire thing depends upon your nostalgia for it. It maybe perhaps is soulless, as you've mentioned before.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It has to work independently of the nostalgia, right? You know, the thing has to be a good story with or without that. And if all you have is a bunch of nostalgia points, then you get, you know, it's literally like Ready Player One, where, you know, like, hey, look, it's that thing I remember over and over. Like, that doesn't mean anything. Like, yeah, I saw that movie. I remember that thing, but you're not making a point with it, right? You're not using it to do anything. You're not using it to tell anything new. You're literally just hoping that I'll get this little dopamine rush from seeing something I recognize. And that will get you a little bit of the way. It'll smooth over some cracks, but you can't make a whole work of fiction out of it. And right. So, yeah, I'll defer to you on Cobra Kai, which I'll admit and piss off your audience, I have not seen. But, you know, I think, you know, it doesn't matter what the project is. Like you said, it's got to have an angle and it's got to have something to say that's interesting aside from, well, we got the band back together. We shoved them in front of a camera. Isn't that what you wanted?
Yeah, it's easy to do that. It's easy to do that. And I could see how it's tempting from the studio's perspective to do that. You know, just crank it out. Let's see. We've got so many great comments. Governor says, I agree. While it would be interesting to see modern versions of some 80s classics, they feel very of their time and would be difficult to recreate on a similar level nowadays. Matt Moore says, Goonie sequel. I don't think that magic could ever be recaptured.
Did you not play the NES game?
Right. Maybe in a different form of mass media. Maybe so. Mm-hmm. Clifford says, what about 3 o'clock two or a prequel to The Outsiders, which was the book that was then, this is now. And I think that might be a good jumping off point if, for instance, the beloved property already has sort of like a literary follow-up or a literary sequel that presumably has its own story that might be worth telling. So that might be a way to revisit it if it's never been done.
You're talking about where someone writes a sequel book to a movie and then right. someone adapts that thing into a movie. I mean, right. I think all the stuff we've already talked about still applies, right? Whether I don't think changing the medium helps. If someone has written a good sequel that works and they've cracked the code, then in theory, making the movie or adapting it could work. I can think of some examples where that's gone wrong, but I think you have to do that on a case by case basis. So mm-hmm. you know, the one that occurs to me is, Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera, right? Monster hit, huge, huge, huge theatrical experience. It just closed on Broadway, I think this year after what, 30 some odd years. Some guy wrote a fan fiction book called The Phantom of Manhattan about, you know, his continuing adventures with these characters after the end of that musical. And then Andrew Lloyd Webber himself adapted that into a musical called Love Never Dies, right. which I wouldn't watch that with anybody else's eyes. It blows hard. And again, the reason is because that story had an ending. You can't just, you know, just continuing a story because I love it and I want more of it. There's gotta be something there to make that happen. And especially with, like we said, with like Terminator 2, with some of the Back to the Future, like when the thing kind of ends nicely and, you know, poetically comes to its natural conclusion, reviving it usually is just like, why are you telling me this? It's like basic storytelling, right? Where you look at how a story is structured and you go, why was this part of the story? It didn't go anywhere. It didn't inform anything else that happened, right? And especially if you're trying to do stuff that happens after the ending of the story, it's tough.
Indeed. Read Between the Lines says, nostalgia is what keeps a lot of people from getting depressed in today's society. Nothing bad about nostalgia. I can't get into most of today's music or movies. We need to pick me up sometimes. And Read Between the Lines, I have to say, I love that. I love your avatar. I am from not far from Bridgewater. So very, very, very cool. Good to see that. Doug, I want to bring up an article and I'm just going to read a part of it and I want to get your reaction. Okay. This is an article called The Good and the Bad, Nostalgia Driven Cinema by Tom Joliffe. Apologies if I butchered your last name. It's a great article worth checking out. I'm going to scroll down to one section that might pertain to what we've been talking about. And this is about Ghostbusters Afterlife and using that nostalgia for Ghostbusters to create something like Ghostbusters Afterlife. Okay, so he writes, nostalgia can sometimes be overused, however. It can become a crutch or a distractive tool to push your film through its various stages. Ghostbusters Afterlife always looked like it could go one of two ways. It either is going to balance its nostalgia right, used as a seasoning, or it's going to go overboard and struggle to find its own place in the cinematic world. Response has been mixed, and it would seem for the most part critics and cinephiles have erred on the side of frustration. A film which begins with earnest, quiet, indie aspirations, albeit with a nod to the Goonies or the recent Stranger Things fascination, not unlike Jason Reitman's forte. But it takes a final act twist into basically recycling much of the original film's finale. Characters return, recognizable and popular antagonists who would become merchandise gold after the original film proved a hit. This is where nostalgia becomes an issue, when you're less creating your own legacy and falling back on something pre-existing. Likewise, when you go nostalgia heavy, you have to deliver what fans expect, and one missing ingredient was the self-aware, achingly sarcastic humor of the original, which embraced the sheer ridiculousness of these particular characters in this concept. Bill Murray acted as audience conduit in something almost entirely meta. Afterlife takes a huge, inconsistent tonal shift in the final third, having not particularly nailed the familiar drama preceding it anyway. And so I'll leave that as a prompt to maybe talk about Ghostbusters and nostalgia and how Ghostbusters has been brought back and your thoughts on that.
Well, Ghostbusters is an interesting case because you also have the Lady Ghostbusters movie in there as well. And you're kind of like, it's like having like a control group for your experiment, right? We did a complete reboot and we have a legacy sequel to the same properties and see how they go. I think I like the legacy sequel on this one better than the Lady Ghostbuster one. Partially because at least it's trying to continue the story or do something with it. I felt like it almost felt the Lady Ghostbuster one to me felt like we're trying to tell the original Ghostbusters story without getting caught that's what we're doing. right. So I felt like that caused a lot of problems for me in terms of watching and just going like, but it almost feels like I'm watching, you know, the original Ghostbusters translated into a language that I don't get, and something's getting lost in the translation. I think the other thing I liked about Ghostbusters Afterlife better was, again, you did have a lot of the movie that was more of these, you know, new characters in a new setting, getting to know them a little bit in their kind of familiar squabbling that are not Ghostbusters. They're just, you know, kids. That all kind of worked, but I think the author of that article is dead on, which is the main problem was you eventually circled back to literally the antagonist from the first movie. And the Ghostbusters show up and they blast him with light balls and then it goes away. And the secret to Ghostbusters is the story of Ghostbusters is less important than the fact that it's basically an exceptional sketch comedy movie by these OGs from SNL. Right. You know, it's any individual scene in Ghostbusters is a great sketch. And I don't think either of the two, the Lady Ghostbusters one or the Afterlife, got that right. There's funny moments in it, but like you look at like that scene of Rick Moranis with the colander on his head talking about, you know, how many Shubs and Zools were roasted in the pit of a slore or whatever. Like that's just a funny scene independently of the movie. Bill Murray, electrocuting this poor student just so he can sleep with the other one. Like it's a great comedy sketch is what that is. And they're all stitched together around a fun enough story. And they're fun characters. So trying to go back to that, well, it's like if they had come up with a completely different antagonist for Afterlife, and a different way of maybe, you know, yes, you expect the original characters to show up somewhere, but they sort of just held back on them, had them come back in one scene. It felt like, oh, it didn't feel right. They weren't woven into the movie. You needed a new antagonist and a new thing. And again, it's that newness that makes the parts of that movie work.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, that article talks about sort of like this tonal mismatch potentially with Ghostbusters Afterlife. And I remember a quote or something, Bill Murray was doing the promotional rounds for Ghostbusters Afterlife. And he said something along the lines of, you know, so many people have talked about how, especially the ending for Ghostbusters Afterlife, made them cry, but man, should a Ghostbusters movie make you cry? or something along those lines.
The problem is what's making you cry is not the story of Ghostbusters Afterlife. What's making you cry is your fondness for Harold Ramis being gone in real life. You know, your fondness for those original two movies and going, ah, he's dead. That makes me sad. That's what's making you cry. It's the connection to the real world events, I think. I think if someone had never seen either the original two Ghostbusters and then just watched Afterlife, I don't know that it would move you, especially if you didn't even know who Harold Ramis was or that he had actually died. You know, I think that's the emotional thing that makes that part of the movie work at all. And it's just that, you know, what it felt more like was like, oh, we got to get him in here somewhere. We got to make Egon relevant to the plot. So they came up with this, right? If Harold Ramis had still been alive, I don't think any of that would have been in the movie. It would have been something else entirely.
Yes, indeed. And David Harris says, oh man, I haven't seen Afterlife yet. I've been wanting to though. So apologies about any spoilers. We might talk a little bit about spoilers here. David Harris says, I saw the cartoon growing up.
Which one, the ape or the good one?
Oh my gosh. Oh, that one. I got tricked so many times into watching that. I thought it was the other Ghostbusters. Oh,
that's why it's called The Real Ghostbusters is the good one.
Yeah, the real good. I know. Got to look for the real. No, but I would say if you're a fan, definitely check it out. Like I know a lot of people who are fans of Ghostbusters that really enjoyed Afterlife. I was kind of maybe mildly disappointed by Afterlife. Like there's some good stuff in there. I thought the way they brought back Harold Ramis was reverent, and I think the effects were good. I thought that was good.
I agree with that.
I thought that it had kind of an interesting premise. It was completely taken away from New York City, which was such a huge character, at least in those original Ghostbusters. That setting was almost a character in those movies. Out to Oklahoma, which was great because I lived in Oklahoma, but it was very slow and deliberate, if memory serves. And then all of a sudden wraps up very quickly with that scene you're talking about. And it's kind of a replay of the first Ghostbusters movie. And, I agree. I have to say I enjoyed the post-credit scenes or the scenes that were interspersed with the credits because they were new and they were kind of fun and funny. And I wished that scenes like that had appeared in the movie and were woven into the movie and we could have seen those moments. So definitely stay for the credits. There's that just simple scene. It's kind of referencing the scene that you were talking about with the electric shocks. Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver just in a quick scene. And you got to see Winston. And I'm like, how interesting is this? Like, this is really interesting. Maybe they're making a follow-up. Maybe we'll get to see some
of that.
But
yeah.
Okay. So right. It's sort of like that's some new and fresh stuff. And it's great to see, especially since all this was based on sketch comedy, there are improvisational talents. You'd love to have some of that spark. It seems like the worst thing you could do is give these great talents basically the exactly same lines and material to work with when they're so brilliant and funny and probably come up with such great stuff. I don't know. Just my thoughts.
There's that episode of The Simpsons where Bart has his catchphrase, I didn't do it. And they're literally like, hey, it's the I didn't do it, boy. Say it again. Yeah. Right. Catchphrases lose their luster over time because again, it's just repetition. It's not a new thing. It's not funny anymore just to hear the thing we already heard. And in a weird way, it's even worse in a sequel. Like I'll go back and watch a movie that I like, a comedy I've seen a bunch of times, and I still think it's funny. If I just hear someone repeat the line again, it's like, oh, you couldn't think of something better than just having it repeated. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I think Ghostbusters is an interesting case to look at for sure.
Okay, Doug, we need to get into a big topic. A lot, there's been a lot of money and attention put into this genre, and we have to talk about it, I think. Nostalgia and how it impacts the superhero genre. So it's kind of an interesting case because we've had superheroes forever, starting in comics, and then we've had movie adaptations, TV adaptations. And now we're in a phase where we have so many superhero movies. However, superhero movies are now starting to incorporate nostalgic elements from, say, when we were young in order to attract new audiences. And I was wondering if you might speak to that. For instance, I don't know if you've seen The Flash. Maybe some.
That was the example I thought of immediately.
Okay.
Yeah.
And of course, we've also had Spider-Man No Way Home with Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield appearing in that as well. And so maybe your thoughts on the entire superhero genre and then also how nostalgia is starting to play into superheroes.
Well, again, the superhero stuff has been around long enough that it does pass from nostalgia into tradition, right? So these characters, you know, Superman might as well be Santa Claus at this point. Like, you can do anything you want with them, and it becomes, now the issue is, what's your take, right? We're now into our, you know, what, fifth major Batman, you know? So when you look at No Way Home, No Way Home is a great example, I think, of nostalgia done right. Like, you bring those characters from the Raimi films and the Mark Webb Spider-Man films forward, and you made them interesting to the plot, but the plot is of that movie kind of works around them, and they're this fun element, right? You could have had Spider-Man go up against any antagonist, having it, you know, versions of those characters, right? It didn't have to be Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin and Alfred Molina's Doc Ock to work. It could have been another universe version of those characters, and you still could have told basically the same story, but this was kind of fun, and it was done with a light touch. And so, you know, I ended up really enjoying that. The Flash for me fell flat. And as much as I was, you know, super excited to see Michael Keaton put on a bat suit again, it didn't work for me. And I think part of it was, we actually recorded an episode on Batman 89 that I've been holding in stasis until the strike is over. But one thing we hit on in that episode was how important Tim Burton's vision of Gotham is to that franchise working, so that when you took Michael Keaton in The Flash, he's Michael Keaton, and he's wearing Michael Keaton's Batman suit, but he's not inhabiting Tim Burton's world. The yes. world of Gotham City in that movie is just, it's a city. It could be Gotham in any other iteration of Batman we've seen. And watching The Flash run around Tim Burton's version of Gotham would have been very interesting, but that's not what we got. And so I think that was a big reason it fell flat, was you had the man, but not the tone. And similarly, when you got to the end of that movie, spoilers for the end, there were a few other cameos that came up, including Christopher Reeve as Superman. You just saw him. He didn't say anything. He was there. It wasn't terrible. But right next to him was Nicolas Cage as Superman, which, if people don't know, there was this effort to get this Nicolas Cage Superman movie made, and it never came to fruition. And like, that worked for me, of like, okay, that was clever. You pulled this pop culture thing from the past that we've never seen. And if you're talking about what would Superman like be from an alternate dimension, great idea to have it be this Nick Cage thing that never happened, right? Fantastic idea. Putting it next to the old school Superman and Supergirl, that one felt very much like, see, there he is. There's that guy you like is Superman. And all it did was make me feel sad. Christopher Reeve and what happened to him, you know, it didn't work. So even though they're sort of drawing on this, it's a great comparison of like a multiverse where these other versions of the characters exist. And I think it's just that the earlier Marvel iterations of those characters from the Raimi and Webb movies are a better fit for the MCU. They still kind of work within the modern MCU and its tone. And especially when you brought in Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire to kind of finish it off, it all worked together. It felt of a piece, and it felt like we're doing this because we have a good idea, and this is for love of the audience. The Flash felt like for love of money. It was just like, okay, if we put Michael Keaton's Batman in there, because it's not written to be Michael Keaton's Batman. It's a man named Bruce Wayne with a bat suit. Mm-hmm. They just made it Michael Keaton. It didn't, you know, feel like his character or his world. So it just wasn't the same. It was, again, it was, you know, trying to push that nostalgia button for that nostalgia treat without the heart and soul behind it that it needed to kind of work.
You know, it's so interesting. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because with Michael Keaton's Batman, Tim Burton's original Batman, I agree. Like, I had fun watching the Flash movie. I didn't hate it. I enjoyed seeing Michael Keaton again, but my goodness, you are right. You watch the Flash and you realize just how important production design, cinematography, that entire world that was created for Tim Burton's Batman, how important that is for Michael Keaton to inhabit. And that just, it wasn't there. One example, I think, was the fact that they went back and it looked like inside Wayne Manor were the same sets. I don't know if it's the same place or if it was recreated. They used the same sets as the original 1989 Batman. But to me, it was just so important. It showed the importance of cinematography and mood. And it was just not shot the same way that the 89 Batman movie was shot. And so you didn't feel like you were in the same place. Like you could recognize it was the same location, but just the cinematography was different. The visual presentation, the composition was just different. So you didn't feel like you're in that world. And then as you said, once Batman leaves or Bruce Wayne leaves, then, I mean, he's in a totally different world. He is not in his sort of a Tim Burton comfort zone. And it's just something just feels not quite right.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you don't spend any time in Gotham City in that movie, other than Wayne Manor itself, right? They go off to, I think, Russia to try and rescue Supergirl, right? So you're immediately out of that location. Tim Burton's Batman is shot, except for the fact that it's in color, like some 1920s German expressionist nightmare movie.
Right.
Every building, every structure is threatening and oddly designed and weird. And the people that inhabit Gotham City are weird and they're mostly monsters. And like, it's the kind of place where like, you know, you see a person and you wonder like, was that guy just eating a rat and now he's chasing me? Like it's all full of these, like just nightmare after nightmares after nightmares. You wouldn't, the Joker says in that movie, he has a line, he goes, decent people shouldn't live here. Right.
Right.
That is Gotham City and Tim Burton's Batman. And I love it. Like it's a great fit. We don't spend any time there in the Flash. And Michael Keaton's Batman is in a way, you know, just as Batman is always a response to the crime of and the world of Gotham City. That's what that character represents. Michael Keaton's Batman is an outgrowth of this version of Gotham City. So when you take him and transplant him out of it, that character does seem out of place. Because Gotham City in Tim Burton's mind is a fantasy, right? In Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, the idea is, can we make Gotham as realistic as possible? Just so right. Christian Bale's Batman, I like him very much. He would not work if you put him in Tim Burton's world. It would be the wrong fit. And so again, that's the sense of trying to like, you know, we hit on the nostalgic idea of, wouldn't it be fun to see Michael Keaton be Batman again? But they didn't do the homework to give you everything else you needed in that movie to make him feel like he was truly back. It just felt like I'm watching an actor put on a costume again.
Right. And, you know, my wife actually said to me after the Flash was over, you know, talking about Superman, and we, as you mentioned, we get to see Nicolas Cage's Superman finally, briefly. You know, she said, you know, I was hoping that the Nicolas Cage Superman was going to show up or be part of the movie somehow.
Or do something.
And I could also say that about the Christopher Reeve Superman. Like, again, you're right. It's not horrible. It was cool to see him again. He was just kind of there in his own section of the multiverse.
They're all just sort of looking and watching. They're not doing anything.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been great to see Christopher Reeve Superman do something. Like, if they're going to use him, it would be great to see him do something. And maybe the same thing with Nicolas Cage as well. And so you're right. I think you can see that the reason is money. I mean, it got me interested when I heard that Nicolas Cage, his Superman was going to be in The Flash, or when I heard that Michael Keaton was going to be in The Flash, it got me interested. And I have a feeling that's exactly why they were included to get us
to buy a ticket, didn't it?
Yeah. Yep. So here's my big question for you, Doug. Is nostalgia bad for us in terms of, are we just getting regurgitated things? Is the quality of our content now worse than, say, the 90s when they were doing this a lot less? Of course, there were sequels back then. But it seemed like everything now is, or everything with a huge budget, has to be a huge budget, is a reboot, remake, or sequel. That's basically getting us to buy the same thing again. And I'm wondering if all this nostalgia and this awareness of nostalgia is lowering the quality of our entertainment. And is it bad for us? Do we need to kick nostalgia to the side a little bit?
I'm going to say no to the idea that nostalgia is inherently bad. Because it's not. I think, you know, we love these things from our past for a reason, because they are good, because they brought us a lot of joy. I think the studio production view of our nostalgia is very cynical and very short-sighted. And so they are, you know, as with all businesses, they're trying to give us what they think we want, right? You know, if the Flash sucked and Spider-Man No Way Home was good, the ticket price was the same and they got you in the theater, right? So as long as they're getting you to buy a ticket, there's no incentive to make the product any better than it has to be just to get you to buy in. So is nostalgia that it's bad when the studio calculation is that cynical and just says, you will go to see this because we know you like this thing and you'll want to see it again. But nostalgia itself is it's just a part of what all great artists do. They are inspired by what comes before. And so, you know, yeah, the guys who, like we talked about before, the guy, you know, George Lucas was inspired by the stuff from his childhood. He goes off and makes the things that inspire us now. And hopefully, instead of just saying, we'll give you Indiana Jones 5, right? Someone said, hey, let's make this Uncharted series of video games. Those are a lot of fun. Or Tomb Raider, right? Treasure hunting stuff. Inspired. It's different. It's something new, right? There's ways to take the thing that you love and say, I want to make the Stranger Things. I want to make the thing that's inspired by the thing that I love without literally doing fan fiction, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess fan fiction has its place. It's, you know, good for people to use their, I'm in favor of all kinds of creativity. It's fine. But if all we're getting is fan fiction, then yes, those are empty calories, right? That's not, who's going to be nostalgic for The Flash 30 years from now? Not many people, right?
Right.
And I don't know if that movie's going to go through what a lot of movies go through, where there's that like cultural reevaluation of, no, that thing that sucked was actually good, you know, and here's why. Here's my treatise on the Star Wars prequels. And it's like, I don't need to hear it, man. I saw those movies. They're pretty bad, right? I watched Pod Racing. It's enough. So I think that there needs to be a place where some studios are willing to take that risk and see the connection between, here's the thing that we're inspired by, and no, we're not bringing back the name of the franchise or the characters, right? Or even the setting. It's a new thing that has all of not the superficial stuff from the original thing, but the heart, right? It's bringing the heart of the thing forward to something new. I don't know that I need a new Beetlejuice, but I would love to see a movie about quirky ghosts in some weird, you know, strange afterlife. There's room for that. There's lots of room for those stories. So, you know, that's what I would want to see going forward, right? Show me the new thing you want to make with my 80s and 90s toys. Not just show me the toys I already have.
Right. So one example of that, and this is just my opinion, the most soulless movie I've seen, and this is just my opinion, and I only got 30 minutes into it before I had to turn it off, so maybe it got better, I don't know, is sadly the Robert Zemeckis live action Pinocchio. That to me was just the epitome of what you're talking about. It looked like a movie, and Tom Hanks plays Geppetto. It's a Disney movie, and it doesn't need to exist. It almost, the jokes in that movie seem like the filmmakers hate the fact that they're making it, but it's almost like an assembly line product, and it doesn't feel like there's any love in there. And I don't know. I hope we can get away from that. And I will say, it seems like Disney's, just my opinion, has been relying on that kind of empty nostalgia push for a while, for their properties. I hope they get back to, because what they used to do was, I think exactly what you're talking about, say the original movies like Snow White and Pinocchio, these were fairy tales that were known, you know, culturally known, and they took it into their heart. They came up with their own presentation and interpretation of it, and they added their artistry that was very unique to them and created things that the world had never seen. And I hope that Disney gets back to that, because obviously a number of very, very talented people are working at Disney, and I hope they get back to doing things like that. So Doug, I want to point people to your podcast, Nostalgia Arcanum.
Of course.
And I wanted to give you the final word about nostalgia, your pitch for it. And if you could control the universe or have influence on the types of things that we're going to get in the future, what your thought is on that and what you would do.
That's a huge question. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. This has been a blast. I love having you on my show, and then just getting to talk to you is great. So
likewise,
I really, really, really enjoyed this. As far as like a final pitch for nostalgia, I mean, that's like having a pitch for inspiration, right? It's all, as one of your viewers had pointed out, it just feels like you're going back to something good when I feel bad. Right. That's been the fun for me doing this podcast, is going like, you know, every week there's that thing that I get to talk about with somebody that makes them super happy, and often me too. Right. It's usually something I also have a strong affinity for. And it's, you know, it is good to relive the good old days. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's good to let those good memories from the good old days turn into new things. I think, you know, you mentioned Pinocchio, right? Pinocchio was derivative. It was based on a book that somebody already wrote. And there have been many versions of it. We just got one from Guillermo del Toro that is great, right? Mm-hmm. There's still life in the little wooden puppet. But yeah, the Disney one was, you know, them literally trying to just revive the thing and do it over again, right? And there was no life in that little wooden puppet that time. So it's a good metaphor for this. If I was in control of the universe, I would say, yeah, let's give the legacy sequels a rest. Let's, you know, it's okay for things to have a good and satisfying ending, and for that to be it. And, you know, for us to, you know, it's much better to imagine the further adventures of Indiana Jones than it is to try and crank out more. You know, the character lives in your mind, and, you know, hopefully someday someone will make something based on that, that they love. So I'm all in favor for good things coming to an end, as the Star Trek, right? All good things, that's the end.
Yes.
You know, so I don't think nostalgia is bad for us. It's when it becomes when it's the only thing, when it's a crutch, right? And not a stepping stone. So hopefully that answers your question.
It does, Doug. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Everyone, check out Doug's podcast, Nostalgia Arcanum. If you're so inspired, please leave him a good review on all podcast platforms. We do have an episode coming up on Resident Evil 4 that you guys might want to check out. And Doug, this was just so much fun, and I look forward to having you back to talk about other topics in the future.
Likewise, and of course, the same invitation extends to you, sir. We're always happy to have you on our show.
Doug, thanks again. And everyone, we look forward to seeing you next time on KenCast. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Want to be part of the live KenCast show? Subscribe to the Ken Cole YouTube channel and hit the notification bell to get alerts about every new show. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next time on KenCast.